Hello everyone. So we have Nick Pentridge with us talking about on building scalable recommendation system with Apache Spark, Kafka, and Elasticsearch. So I am handing over to Nick.
Okay. Everybody hear me okay? Great. Okay, thanks everyone for being here. It's great to be here in Spain. Thanks for attending this talk. Today I'll be talking about building a scalable recommender system using Apache Kafka, Apache Spark, and Elasticsearch. A little bit about me, handle MLNick on Twitter and GitHub, you can find me there. I'm currently a principal engineer working with IBM, a member of the Apache Spark project management committee, focused predominantly on machine learning, and finally author of the book Machine Learning with Spark. Today we're going to give an overview of recommender systems and how they fit into the machine learning workflow, then talk a bit about how to model data for our recommender system, answer the questions why use Spark, Kafka, and Elasticsearch, why we're going to use these particular components, talk a bit about Spark streaming and integrating that with Kafka and Elasticsearch for recommender systems, using Spark ML for collaborative filtering, and finally deploying and scoring recommender models with Elasticsearch, and then monitoring and feedback, and scaling that model serving. If we have time, I'll try and do a little demo at the end. So why recommender systems? What is important about them? Well, they're one of the most ubiquitous and well-known use cases of machine learning, probably one of the earliest commercial applications of machine learning systems. They're all over the place. They've probably touched many people's lives. You've seen them within companies like Amazon, Netflix, and the business case is clear. For many of these companies, in particular online companies that are using recommender systems, a substantial amount of their revenue is actually driven by these systems. So for example, Amazon ascribes roughly 35% of their entire revenue to a recommender system. And for companies such as Netflix, it's even higher, it's closer to 70%. So we'd like to create our own recommender system for our business. And we're going to just use our typical machine learning workflow, which is we have a bunch of data. It's sitting around. We're going to do some machine learning on it and make money. So that's the end, right? Easy. Well, of course, the reality is different. The machine learning workflow has a lot of moving parts. It starts with data. This data can be historical data. It can be coming in a streaming fashion. Normally, it's both. It's sitting in various data stores. It's coming from various places. It's coming from user behavior, from external systems. It's coming from internal systems. And we need to then take that data, these disparate data sources, ingest them into our pipeline and our workflow. We then need to do processing, feature transformation, feature engineering, normalization on that data to get it into a form that is usable in our machine learning model. But that's not the end. We can't just feed that data into our model and away we go. We need to actually do model selection, evaluation, cross-validation, this whole model feedback, training, testing loop within our pipeline. And now we have a model that works, that it performs well on our test data, and we're going to deploy it to the real world. But we want to worry about things like not just the model, we have to deploy the entire pipeline. So we have to take that raw data in our production pipeline and process it in exactly the same fashion that we do in our training pipeline. We need to do that in the real live environment. We need to worry about things like model versioning. And then finally, in our live system, we're predicting given new data, and we have to look at things like monitoring the performance of this machine learning model and this whole system, doing live evaluation, and checking, understanding how that performance is changing over time. Is our model deteriorating? Has the pattern of our data changed? Do we need to change something? And that live system data, both predictions and the feedback from the system, as well as the new data that's arriving, needs to come into this feedback loop, which comes back into the beginning of our pipeline. It feeds back into our historical data, as well as the ingest step. So this is a complex workflow, and it's something that no one system necessarily does. So Spark is a great fit for the middle, piece there, but really, what do we do for the deployment phase? It's an unsolved problem. There's a few systems out there, but it's a tricky one. So today we'll talk about the recommender version, and in particular using Elasticsearch to plug these two gaps. First of all, to store data, and secondly, to deploy models and score them. So the recommender machine learning workflow looks the same, but it has a few peculiarities. So our data consists of typically users in our system. They're doing things with our system, they're interacting with it, and typically they're interacting with other users or they're interacting with items. So other users in a social network, items in an online store, movie site, what have you. And those interactions and their user behavior creates user event data. So your typical stream of user events in a kind of web business, for example. We're going to continue to use Spark data frames and ML for the ingest, data processing, and model training piece. In particular, for data processing, we need to aggregate event data, and we need to have a way to handle implicit data, which I'll talk a little bit about later. Model training is actually one of the simplest aspects of this because Spark gives us some great tools for that and has built-in, highly scalable, collaborative filtering recommender model that we can use. And then finally, we have the deployment and live scoring phase, and that's where we're going to use Elasticsearch. So we have to deal with model size and complexity. We might have millions and millions of users and items in our system. We need a scalable, distributed type system that can handle that. And then our live system needs to serve recommendations to users and create things like similar item recommendations, similar products, et cetera. And we need to monitor the behavior of that system, feedback, apply filters to our scoring, and so on. So feedback is just another event type in the system. You know, when we survey a recommendation, we can log that, and it gets put into our streaming system and back into our data ingest and our data storage system. And we're going to use Kafka for the streaming element. So I'll talk a little bit about what the data models look like in a typical recommender system. So as I mentioned before, we have a few different entities in the system. The first and probably the most important are users. Users come to our website, they come to our online store, our YouTube channel, whatever the case may be, and they do things. They interact with our system. And typically, they interact with other users. In a social network, they might follow them, they might have lists of users, et cetera. And they also typically interact with items. Now, an item, we don't have to have even one type of item in our system. It could be movies, it could be products, it could be books, it could be multiple types of items. But typically, we can describe each of these as a little JSON blob, for example. It's a bunch of metadata fields, typically has a user ID, name, and some user demographics or metadata, such as geolocation, age, etc. Items look pretty similar. You want to identify them with an ID, a name. Typical things are categories, tags, dates. But there's also some interesting sort of metadata that is related to activity, for example, the number of likes that a movie has. The last time it was active, the authors, and so on. So why are these important? Well, two reasons. The first is business rules. We might need to apply business rules based on user demographics or based on geolocation. For example, in our movie site, we may not be able to show movies in a certain location due to licensing restrictions, so we need to filter based on those things. We may not want to show age-restricted content. Again, we filter based on user demographics. And similarly for items, we might want to show recommendations within a category. We might want to only show popular videos or perhaps less popular videos to do long-tail recommendations. So all of these are critical elements of our live recommender system. So all these users and items eventually feed through to what the most important component and what we use to actually learn, and that's behavioral data. So this is made up of user interactions. Our users come in and do things in our system. They might be visiting a page, they might be adding something to their cart, they might be previewing or watching a movie, listening to a music item, initiating search queries, sharing, et cetera, et cetera. Typically, we might have a little bit of what we call explicit preference data, which is when someone says, I do like this thing. They issue a review giving 4 stars. They issue a rating to a movie. But the overwhelming majority of this data is what we call implicit preference data. So the fact that someone viewed a page or even added something to their cart is an indication of preference. It says that they more than likely do like this thing, but it's not an explicit indicator. So we don't know for sure that they definitely like something. It might be a mistake. They might have clicked on an ad, you know, in error. They might add something to their cart and later, and even purchase it, but later return it, etc. So again, we can represent this user event as a typical little JSON blob with the important information such as the user ID that initiated this event, the item ID that it's related to, the event type, page view, like, share, etc., and a bunch of contextual metadata, so the geolocation, the device type, the time of day, these kind of things. So I mentioned implicit feedback earlier. How do we handle this in this type of recommender system? Well, one way that I've found fairly easy to use and also very successful in real-world systems is to apply a weighting scheme. So because a page view is an indicator, an implicit indicator of preference, it may have a weighting of 1. You know, it means that someone might like something, but it's a fairly sort of lightweight weighting. However, if someone purchases something, the weight might be 5 or it might be 10. So there's a few ways to apply these weightings. You could use a sort of predefined system that you work out based on your business or your particular use case. You might be data-driven. You might look at the relative ratios of these events in the system and apply a weighting like that. It might be outcomes-driven, so applying weightings based on profit or profitability of a product, for example, things like that. There's various ways, and I don't think there's one, you know, true answer, but this is one way to handle it. Okay. So before delving into the detailed aspects of streaming, model training, and serving, you know, why these particular systems? I mean, there's many systems out there. Why choose these? Well, Kafka, I mean, I think the answer is pretty easy. I think everyone would agree that it's the de facto enterprise message hub or centralized message queue these days. Highly scalable, plugs into just about every system, and in particular for the fact that we're using Spark, it has good integration with Spark streaming and even structured streaming, the new version of streaming, although it's still new and very rough. Why Spark? Well, these events and metadata are, I guess, what you can call lightly structured data. They are typically sort of fairly shallow, sometimes nested JSON-type data structures, and that's fairly well suited to a data frame SQL-style approach. But the schema is fairly flexible. You know, not all fields are present and so on. So again, useful to use data frames there. Data frames have a really good pluggable external support for other third-party data sources, including Elasticsearch and various, you know, Apache Big Data ecosystem projects. And SparkML, well, probably the easiest answer for all of these systems, it provides a really neat pipeline API for model training, cross-validation, feature extraction, and putting all of that together. And it has a highly scalable alternating least squares model for collaborative filtering, and it handles implicit feedback. So why Elasticsearch? And I should just point out that this can probably apply equally to Apache Solr. You know, my experience has been with Elasticsearch. That's why I use it, but it applies equally. Storage is native JSON, so we can very easily map these user and item data storage blobs and event data onto the Elasticsearch storage model. Highly scalable. It's got very good support for time series event data, which is exactly what we're dealing with here. And we get some really nice tools for free, such as Kibana for data visualization. Integrates well with Spark data frames. Not quite as well with the latest versions, and I'll mention that later, but very well with the earlier versions. And then finally, search and recommendations are two sides of the same coin. They look fairly similar. In search, we're trying to return the most relevant results for a given search query. With recommendations, we're kind of doing the same thing, but without a query. Or where you can think of it as where the query is, in fact, the user itself, or the item that we're trying to find similar products for, or similar items for. So search and recommendations are quite closely tied together, and we'll get to that in more detail later. But we also get things that are very important for our system, like filtering, aggregations, and so on, grouping. Okay, so our system starts with the data and the event stream. So we've got a fairly straightforward pipeline here. We take this raw event data, pop it into Kafka, a bunch of topics, you know, it could be the event topic, and we're going to use Spark Streaming to process this data and do a few things with it. So the first thing is really simply writing this data to an event store. So this is a simple use of Spark Streaming, where we're just going to use the fact that Spark integrates nicely with other storage systems. Yeah, and this applies at the moment to Elasticsearch here, but you can certainly use it for writing to any other scalable data store that you wish, Cassandra, HBase, et cetera. So it looks something more or less like this. You have an event stream, and I'm going to do for each RDD on this, take the raw data, map it into an Elasticsearch document, give it an ID for writing to Elasticsearch, and then write it to an event index. The second use case is very similar to the event store, and that's plugging into tools like such as Kibana to have dashboards. So I can take the raw event stream, and I can create time series graphs. I can do geolocation mapping. So I can take the geolocation of those events. I can see where the events are coming from, things like that. I can also run streaming aggregations on that event data to create higher level dashboards, aggregated perhaps by day or by week, et cetera. So as part of this event stream, I have activity data about what is happening with items in my system. So I mentioned earlier that you might want to be filtering based on, let's say, the number of likes that a video has received, or the recency of that video, when it was added, when it was last played. These might be filters or aspects of your system that you want to include. So in order to do that, you can try and do that in real time based on, let's say, Elasticsearch aggregations or some real-time aggregations within your system, but really that's not particularly scalable. So if you can live with a few hundred milliseconds or a few seconds or even a few minutes of latency, of end-to-end latency on these kind of metrics, and typically that's kind of okay in these types of systems, then you can aggregate in real time on the stream, sum up the number of likes over some time window, perhaps a few windows, and then use these as filters later. And similarly for users, we can do the same thing. What's important here is that in addition to activity metrics, we would actually like to record a little bit of history about what that user has done, what items they've interacted with. So this is important. For example, how many times have you been to Amazon, you've bought something, and then a new washing machine or a toaster, and the first thing they recommend to you is more toasters, right? Or exactly the toaster that you've just bought. Okay, this happens a lot. And that user experience in a recommender system is awful. You think, well, this is supposed to be the most advanced recommendation engine on the planet, and it's doing silly things. So item exclusions are very important, not just based on user metadata, but what items they've interacted with. If you've just purchased something, don't show that same product. In fact, you might not want to show that same category. You might want to use that purchase category to show some sort of more serendipitous or related categories, but not the same category. All of these can be done using your streaming system by taking the user interactions and aggregating them in real time. I'll just talk a little. That was the old, or let's say a current version of Spark Streaming, the DStream version. I'll talk a little bit about structured streaming. It's fairly new and fairly rough. It was introduced in Spark 2.0. Kafka initial support was added in Spark 2.0.2. There's no full Elasticsearch support yet. So it's something that is open. It's not clear whether it'll be a fully blown Spark data source or what is called a for each writer, which is essentially, you know, for each batch in a stream, do something, you know, write it to Elasticsearch. But this is more or less what a structured streaming program, continuous application, let's say, would look like. We have a raw stream that's coming from Kafka, you know, subscribing to our events topic. We take that raw stream, we apply some UDFs against it to extract the event data into this JSON or Elasticsearch map format, and we write that using some for each writer. You know, for each batch in the stream, we write it to Elasticsearch. So in this way, we get continuous application, which is running in structured streaming and all the benefits of data frames with streaming support. Okay, so I'll cover a little bit about the background of collaborative filtering, not too much detail. But essentially, we've got this event stream of user behavior, what users have done, what movies. You know, I'm going to use the tried and tested movie rating example to illustrate this. So we can aggregate that event stream up into a ratings matrix. So on the one axis, we have users, and on the other, we have our movies. And for each user and movie combination, we get the movies that they've rated. So in the typical explicit setting where we actually have ratings, this is what it might look like. It's very sparse, so not every user has rated every movie. So we want to essentially fill in all these little gaps in this rating matrix, and that is collaborative filtering. One way of doing this is matrix factorization. So we split this user movie rating matrix up into two different matrices. The first is a user factor matrix, and the second an item factor matrix. So each user is itself is represented as this lower dimensional representation, a lower dimensional dense vector. So we've taken the sparse ratings matrix, represented as these two dense matrices. And there's no particular interpretation for these vectors, but they're what's known as latent features. So they might capture the affinity that a user has for certain types of movies, for certain directors, this kind of thing. And similarly for items, they capture this co-occurrence of ratings. So movies that tend to get rated highly by the same users tend to be similar to each other in some way. And again, these latent features might be representative of, for example, you know, categories, directors, actors, genres. So what's nice about matrix factorization models is it makes prediction easy, because in order to predict the expected rating of a user for one movie, we just take these two vectors and we do some very basic linear algebra, we do a dot product, and we come up with a prediction. So in this way, we can predict for each item, we can predict a rating for the users, we can rank them in order, and we can say that, you know, the top 10 ranked predictions are the most likely to be rated highly or liked by that user, and we're going to show those as recommendations. And that's the basic idea. So in order to create one of these models in SparkML, we've got our Elasticsearch data source. We've got all our events that are sitting there in our index. And we're just going to use our data frame data source and read that into our data frame. So a typical event table might look like this. The user ID, item ID, it'll have a timestamp in there, the event type, and importantly, this little weight column that we have. So this is the weight that we assigned. And as I've done there, you know, you might have a weight of 1 for a page view indicating like preference. You might have 2 for an add to cart, so that's another sort of slightly stronger indicator of preference. And then a purchase is a much stronger indicator of preference. So now, how do we go from this event view to our ratings matrix view that we saw earlier? Well, fortunately, it's fairly straightforward. Because we've just assigned a weight to each event, you know, we just do a simple group by the user and the item ID, sum all of those up, and we get what is effectively this rating matrix. For each user and item combination, we have a rating. Now, a note about implicit preference data, these ratings are not truly ratings in the model. So the fact that someone viewed something, then added to the cart, then purchased it, doesn't mean that they gave it a rating of 6 or 7 or 8 or whatever the case may be. But we treat these ratings as what we call confidence metrics or confidence weights. So we split the model, even though it's hidden to to you as a SparkML user, the model effectively splits up the matrix into one which is a weight matrix. So it applies, the higher weights is it's more likely that a user likes this item or this movie, and the other is the sort of binary preference matrix. And what we're actually trying to solve is this binary preference matrix. We want to be able to predict, if a user likes an item, it's more likely to be closer to one, and if they don't, it's closer to zero. But for the user, all we have to do is get our data into this format, this weight matrix format, set the implicit pref flag to true, and fit our model as if it was a ratings matrix. So it makes life very easy. Okay, so now we've gone from the data ingest through to our pipeline. I haven't really covered cross-validation, just for time and so on, but you can, of course, plug into the built-in SparkML cross-validator classes and pick the best settings for your model, all the parameters that you can set. There's a few different knobs that you can tune there. But now what do we do? Okay, we don't really have any way to go from this model that we've built to using it in a production live system. This is that missing piece. So how are we going to do this? Well, first I'm going to talk a little bit about search. So as I mentioned, search and recommendations sound kind of similar. In search, we start with a query. Okay, we're looking for cat videos. And what a search engine does is it takes that query and it represents it as what is called a term vector. So for each term in the query, that's represented as a one in this example. So the frequency of that term, how many times it appears in the query. And that is a sparse vector that is as big as all the terms that we could possibly have. But of course, because there's only two terms in the query, we only need two non-zero entries. And then we take that vector and we compute a measure of similarity across our entire corpus of documents, videos in this case. And the more terms, roughly speaking, the more terms that a query and a document have in common, the more likely they are to be a match, and the more similar they are. So a search engine will apply weightings to this term frequency, inverse document frequency, and Lucene and Elasticsearch and Solr, by inheritance, have a much more complex scoring system. But roughly speaking, the core idea is the same. And then finally, once we've got these similarities, we just sort the results and we return the top 10, or top 20, whatever the case may be. So that's a relevance measure. So this looks quite similar to what we would want to do with recommendations. We would start with a user, if we want user recommendations, or an item vector, perhaps, if we want to do similar items. We want to compute some measure of similarity or some relevance score for every document or movie in our corpus. We want to sort the results and return, again, the top 10 or the top 20. Okay, so the ranking part is easy because search engines are good at ranking, and once we've got a set of scores for each document, we can easily rank. What about the rest? Well, scoring, okay, we know that that both Elasticsearch and Solr, in fact, provide some quite flexible custom scoring mechanisms. So, can we plug into that? Can we do some custom similarities? Maybe. But the first part is a challenge because we're dealing with different things. Our user vector is a dense vector, and it's not a term frequency vector. It's just a normal set of real numbers. If we try and index this vector straight into a search engine, what we're going to end up with is that every value in that vector is treated as a term with an occurrence of one. And if you just try and naively apply this, well, you end up with garbage, unfortunately. Okay, so we're stuck. We have to go and look for some other solution to this problem. Well, maybe not. So I'll talk about the delimited payload filter, which is digging quite deep into the Lucene internals. It's something that's not really used that much, but turns out that we can use it to solve our problem. So Lucene has a concept of something called a payload, which can be attached to a term in our index. So if we take our raw vector and we represent it as this delimited string, where the vector indexes or indices are our terms, 0, 1, 2, up to whatever, n minus 1, and the payload is our vector value. Then if we use a custom analyzer which applies this delimited payload filter, and we enable term vectors in our search engine, we actually end up with something that looks like this, where for each term, we have obviously a term frequency of 1, okay, because it only occurs once. But we can attach the payload to the vector index. Okay, so now once you've got that, it turns out that we can actually access those payloads during scoring. So we write a custom script. We use compiled JavaScript for speed. And more or less what we do is for each document, when we're at scoring time, we extract the payload for the given term. So for the vector index 0, we extract the vector value as the payload. And for our query vector, we take the query value or the vector value at the same index. We multiply them together, and we add up those scores. That's a cosine. A vector dot product. And then in addition to that, we can normalize those queries with the vector norms to create a cosine similarity. So on the left, we've got what the custom scoring function looks like. We use our custom script. We pass in a query vector. We query against a field, which is this delimited payload field that we've created, and we use cosine or not. Okay, so we've now delved deep into the internals of the search engine, and we've bent Elasticsearch to our will, and we have a search engine that can do recommendations. So we've got our user vector or item vector. We turn that into a format that the search engine can understand and that we can actually use in our custom scoring function. That custom scoring function generates relevance scores, which is either a simple dot product or a cosine similarity. We sort the results, and we get exactly what we want. So why do we even bother about this instead of just doing the math? Well, we get all the search engine functionality for free, right? So now, instead of having different systems, one that scores, and then one, feed that to one that filters, and you have three round trips per recommendation call, we now have something where our items are stored, along with all of their metadata, in a search engine. We issue this custom query scoring function, but we can filter, group, do range queries, filter by category, filter by the number of likes, geolocation, and we can combine all of these together in a search query in many different ways. We can even combine the results of a particular query. It could be a free text search. It could be geometrically decreasing geolocation kind of function score. We can combine all of those together in completely flexible ways with our custom recommendation scoring system. And then finally, this deployment becomes a simple write operation. So we just take the output of our model, which is a set of factors for each user or item ID, and we write it to our Elasticsearch index. Okay, the final component is monitoring and feedback. It's not enough to just deploy the system, make our recommendations. We need to know a few things. We need to know, number one, how is the system performing? Is it deteriorating over time? Is it achieving the business goals that we want it to? So typically what we want to do is monitor things like the click-through rates, the amount of revenue generated by recommendations. All of these things need to be part of the systems that we can monitor. We want to do A/B testing on new models to see if they increase or decrease these metrics, and so on. We also want to know whether to retrain that model. So it may be that the model only needs to be retrained every week or every day. We might want to use a combination of time since the last model retraining. We may also want to include things like if the model starts deteriorating by a certain amount on some business metric, then we retrain or we switch over to some backup, et cetera. So one way, the way to do this is to just treat a recommendation event as another event in our system. So we just log the fact that a user was shown these IDs, we can log the model that showed it, we can log the event time, geolocation, any kind of metadata that you want. And then if an action is taken on that, we can log a recommendation action event. So we can just note that a user clicked on a certain item or they bought it and so on. So in this way, if a user clicks on or takes action on recommendations, you know, clicks, purchases, et cetera, we can directly know the impact of our system and our recommendations on our business metrics just by doing simple aggregations. So we feed all of these events into the same pipeline, Kafka Spark Streaming pipeline that we have. And again, we can write those raw events to our event store. We can do some analytics and aggregations on them to create dashboards. We can use these recommendation served events to do things like impression capping or fatigue. So we may not want to show the same recommended product to a user 100 times. You know this from retargeting in the online world. If you go and look at a product, that product follows you around the web for the next month. It starts to become very frustrating to a user. It may work when you show them two or three times, but you definitely want to work on a fatigue model or capping the number of times you show the same product to someone. Okay, so finally, I'll just talk about how does this model scoring actually scale? Because we're using custom scoring functions. Is it fast? Well, I mean, it's certainly true that the end-to-end performance of scoring may not be quite as fast as the pure math, linear algebra. But this just gives you an idea, how it scales with item set size and the dimension of our factor vector. So you typically, in these domains, want a vector, a lower dimensional representation of something like 20, 50, 100, 200, something like that. But typically 20 or 50 will do a pretty good job, depending on the item set size. So you can see that obviously with a small item set size, we can very easily get to 20, 50, 20, 40 millisecond times or latencies. With large item set size, it becomes it increases quite a lot, especially as we increase the amount of work that scoring function is doing. And the reason for this is a search engine is not necessarily designed to score 1 million documents to actually compute those scores a million times. It's really designed to apply a lot of filtering and then score only that subset. So when you have a small item set, it works really well. When you have a very large item set, you can see that it starts to it's still perfectly good for many use cases. So it depends on your latency requirements, but it starts to deteriorate. So one way we can address this is we typically have a cluster, Elasticsearch cluster. Depending on the size of our kind of business, it may be very large indeed. It might be 3 or 4 nodes, it might be 60 nodes. So one way is to increase the number of shards, and we find that for a small item set, it doesn't really help that much, which is not too surprising because the overhead of searching each shard starts to very quickly starts to kind of eliminate the benefit. But for a large item set, a million, 10 million items, you can see that increasing the number of shards, which is the level of parallelism in our system, helps a lot. So I'm going to kind of unfortunately rush through this a little bit, but one way of solving this problem, especially as our item set starts to get larger and larger, is to use a type of filter, which is locality-sensitive hashing. So more or less what this does is it takes these vectors, turns them into hash signatures, so it uses some random projections and some hashing to create a representation that can be used to estimate a similarity score, in this case, cosine similarity. And when we index our model, we can take the results of the LSH, these buckets, and we can index those along with our model. And roughly speaking, candidates are other items where their vectors would fall into the same bucket. So it's a way of pre-filtering our data set. And that will allow us to trade off this kind of speed and accuracy. Because it's an estimate, you might lose accuracy, but it's a lot faster. So you can see, compared to brute force, we get a huge speed up and we get back down to a much more kind of real-time 50 millisecond type of result. And you can obviously tune those knobs to, you know, to get to either get a more accurate but slightly slower result, or you can go for slightly less accuracy and bring that response time down significantly. And then finally, you know, how does this compare to something that I mentioned before, which is what I call score then search? You know, you could have a dedicated high performance linear algebra system that his only job is to score the model, send the results, and then you use that to filter. Well, it's true that the scoring, the pure scoring in that system, I mean, this was just using, you know, NumPy, which is obviously uses highly optimized linear algebra libraries, but you're talking 10 milliseconds or, you know, whatever the case may be. Yes, it's very fast, but actually sorting that result and then searching ends up being roughly the same as using this kind of brute force approach. So if we apply LSH, you know, both of these would go down, but we can get the end-to-end performance of our system, including all the filtering, search engine functionality that we want, to be as good as a score then search kind of scenario. And we don't have to maintain two or three different systems. We only have to maintain one. So for simplicity, DevOps, scalability, and all of these things, it becomes, you know, a much nicer solution. Okay, I don't think I've got that much time for the demo, 7 minutes. So I'm just going to talk about a bit of future work. So I mentioned that you know, Apache Solr and Elasticsearch are fairly similar in many respects. They're both built on the same, you know, Lucene search engine. So I've created this vector scoring plugin for Elasticsearch, but Solr also has very similar capabilities to allow plugins and custom scoring functions. So it would be great to have a look at a Solr version. I believe that the Elasticsearch scoring performance should actually be a lot better than the numbers that I showed. So I'd like to dig deeper into that and see if it can be improved. Because especially once you filter the LSH, the LSH-based vectors, you know, it's doing a lot less work than it was before, and I believe that it should be faster. And then we talked about what are essentially very simple collaborative filtering or recommender models here. So, you know, it's just a simple matrix factorization. There are a lot of much more complex and high-performance contextual recommender models out there, such as factorization machines. And effectively, what they come down to is a bunch of you know, vector dot products and some sums. So that can fit exactly and neatly into this framework. You know, here we're doing dot product over one vector, but we could, for a factorization machine or contextual model, we could easily do dot products for the users and the context vectors and so on. So I'd like to, you know, take a look at that and see whether it can be incorporated and what the scoring performance of that more complex model looks like. And then finally, as Spark streaming, structured streaming, and the Elasticsearch integration in particular evolves, I think it would be really interesting to look at taking those components and creating a true continuous recommend application that takes a data stream, continually computes aggregations, feeds it into the event store, triggers model updates, computes online models, you know, retrains them, and does monitoring without ever having to be, you know, stopped and started or even run on a, you know, on a sort of batch or a ad hoc or scheduled basis. Okay, thanks for everyone for listening. There's a few references there. You know, obviously the slides will be up. And a couple of links to, first of all, the Elasticsearch scoring plugin that you can use to do the same thing. And then the second one is a meetup that I did recently where I actually did manage to get to the demo. And it's got some notebooks in there where you can see the building the model, deploying it to Elasticsearch, and using the scoring plugin to do recommendations. Thank you.
Anyone with questions?
None?
Could you please explain me again how you used the delimited payload filter? I didn't get it really. well?
Sure. Can I? Okay, it's so essentially the Elasticsearch, or in fact, it's really Lucene, stores each document as you can tell it to store the actual term vector information of that document. So typically, what it'll do is it'll store the term in the inverted index and then map that to the document that it appears in. And that'll be this first element here, which is you see here, the term vector has a term, 0 in this case, and the term frequency 1. So in this particular document, that term 0 appears once. So that might be foo or bar or cat or dog. But what you can do is tell it to also store this payload. And this payload is just a little binary blob that represents typically, it can actually be anything. It could, in theory, be an image or any binary representation. But typically, it'll be some sort of number, a float or double kind of payload. So on the left, we have the raw vector, which will be k-dimensional vector of kind of real numbers. And we represent that as a kind of, in this case, pipe delimited, and that's just the default for this filter, a pipe delimited string, where each little entry represents the index of the vector or the array. You can think of it as a 0 is the first index of the vector, 1.2 is the value, up to, let's say this is of length 5, it's 4 is the index, 0.3 is the value. So really, this is just a way to represent that vector, that real valued vector, in a way that the search engine understands, but more importantly, in a way that you can actually extract later during scoring. So typically, I should point out that if you store a raw vector or an array like that on the left into the search engine, then when at scoring time, when your custom scoring function, when you try and retrieve that, you'll get back something which is sorted by value. Okay, so it because of the way it stores these terms. So typically, what it cares about is term frequency, not the fact that these indices are ordered. So that will result in something completely meaningless when you try and do a dot product. So in this way, we can store the terms in an ordered manner along with the payload, and at scoring time, we can extract that payload. And this is all in the plugin that you can actually go and look at, but effectively, we loop through each index starting at 0. We take the payload value for that index, and we multiply it with the value at the same index for the query. So if these are two vectors, this is exactly how you compute a vector dot product. So I don't know if that makes it any more clear, but. To do these, sorry?
To get the terms. I mean,
the terms.
The terms. If you didn't have Elasticsearch, what kind of libraries would you choose in Apache?
To do the same thing with, you could certainly do this just using Lucene. There's no reason why you couldn't do that. The reason you use something like Elasticsearch or Solr is it does all the heavy lifting for you. But certainly, if you were to just do this in a non-distributed way, to start off simply, you could store each document as a Lucene, each item, vector, or whatever the case may be, as a Lucene document, and you could use Lucene scoring in the same way. I'm not sure whether it allows scoring functions, custom scoring functions. I know how to use them in Elasticsearch. I don't know how to use them in raw Lucene, but you could definitely do that to get the same impact. But I think the power of something like Elasticsearch or Solr is exactly that you get all of the functionality for free. You get all cluster management and indexing and the aggregations and the filtering and all of that, and the REST API, the JSON, all of that kind of stuff.
Thank you, Nick.
Thank you.